Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with Paul Majeed about the second volume of his biography of the 19th century U.S. Army General George Crook, entitled The Gray Fox, George Crook and the Indian Wars. Paul, welcome to the show.
It's nice to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you here. I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I'm a retired former attorney. I say it a former because when I retired, I decided I was not going to practice law any longer and that I was going to try to do some writing. I had worked for the Peace Corps and an outfit called the African Development Foundation, and we were doing economic development in the Third World. And it was a very rewarding but at the same time frustrating career, and on my retirement, I thought I'd try to get as far away from it as possible. And I had a longstanding interest in the Indian Wars, and so I decided that I would do some reading about it. And then from there, I went to the point where I decided that, you know, if I was going to do all this research, maybe I should write a book. So I began to look around for a subject that would tie together a period of perhaps 50 years when the Indian Wars were taking place. And I saw a movie called Geronimo starring, Wes Studi and Gene Hackman, right, as George Crook. And the portrayal of Crook was fascinating because he was both a top-notch expert on Indian fighting, but also was a humanitarian who really cared about the Indians and did a lot to try to help them. And the movie did get that across. And so I began to do some background research on him. And I read, you know, his autobiography, which was about the only thing that at the time had been written about him. And it was a peculiar document because it gives almost no context, and it just kind of rambles through the incidents of his life without giving you much insight into his thinking or anything else. And it had been put together by a sergeant who was stationed at Carlisle Barracks during the war and had come upon this handwritten manuscript that Crook had written in the latter part of his life, and became interested in it and published it as a book with Oklahoma Press in 1946. And that remained until about 2001, the only thing that had been published about the man. So I thought this was a great opportunity to find a subject that I could, you know, tie the Indian Wars together, particularly since he began his career on the West Coast during the Gold Rush in 1852, and served for 9 years in the Northwest, fighting in the Rogue River and some of the other wars that took place out there that are, you know, more obscure now, but at the time were the Indian Wars of that period. In 1861, as everybody is aware, the Civil War broke out, and he, like all other officers, had to choose sides. And being from Ohio, he was a Union man, and he came back to Washington. And he thought, you know, he only had reached the rank of captain after 9 years, and advancement was extremely slow in peacetime in the regular army. So what a lot of officers did, including Crook, was to resign their commissions in the regular army and seek to join one of the state volunteer regiments. And that way he could get a bump up in rank and authority and, you know, contribute more effectively to the war, particularly since at the time there was a real shortage of trained officers. And he was a West Pointer, so, you know, he had that advantage as well. And he talked his way into a colonelcy of a new volunteer regiment in Ohio, the 36th. And from there, he rose to the rank of major general and corps commander by the end of the war. had a very significant career. At the end of that time, he decided that, you know, when the war was over, that he would like to rejoin the regular army, since that was the only career that he really knew. And he applied for, you know, reentry into the service and was accepted at the rank of major. And he was not pleased with that, since it was only one rank up from what he had been before, and he had been a major general and corps commander, as I said. So he appealed the decision, and they, you know, the board that was providing these ranks at the time decided to give him a lieutenant colonelcy, and there was a newly created regiment, and he was put in charge of that regiment. And because of his experience, as, you know, fighting Indians before the war, he was a very important commodity in the West. They were trying to bulk up their forces because the Indians were becoming restive and as being subject to, you know, this increased emigration after the war. And so, you know, they put him out there in Idaho, and the rest is in my book.
You open with him on the boat going to command the 23rd Regiment, and it's really an interesting opening about how this is man who's still in his mid-30s, who is nonetheless going to assume this very heavy responsibility in terms of dealing with the situation in the Great Basin. And I was wondering if you could go into a bit more detail as to the circumstances of the tensions in that region before we discuss a bit the campaign that he waged against the Paiutes.
Well, it was a pretty typical situation, you know, with regard to the Indian Wars. You had the tribes in the Great Basin living on a basically subsistence level. There were nomadic peoples, and they drifted from place to place, hunting and gathering, you know, the wild vegetables and fruits that they could to supplement their diets. And all of a sudden, you had an influx of white immigration of settlers, and in the Great Basin, in particular, miners, because there was a lot of a lot of mineral wealth in that area. And these people came in, and they not only killed off the game that the Indians depended on to, you know, for their livelihoods, but they also, you know, mistreated the Indians because they considered them as something akin to vermin. The early settlers were a pretty rough lot, and in both California and then again in the Great Basin, you know, they would exterminate Indians basically whenever they could. So tensions increased, and finally the tribes who, you know, at that point were the Shoshone, the Paiutes, and so on, were warrior peoples, and they were not going to sit by and watch their lands be taken from them and to accept the abuse from the settlers and the miners, so they rebelled. And the army at the time, as I said earlier, was very thin on the ground and had a hard time trying to, you know, to deal with the Indians, who were very mobile and knew the terrain, which was extremely rough. And they were very elusive, and soldiers would go out on patrol, and they were largely ineffective. They either couldn't find the Indians, or when they did, the Indians, you know, would give them a good trouncing. So by the time Crook got out there, the army was held in contempt by most people, most settlers in the area, who would prefer to felt that they could take things into their own hands. And, you know, there was a lot of vigilantism, which was, you know, equally unsuccessful in curbing the Indian depredations. So Crook found himself in a situation where his presence was welcome because of his reputation as a seasoned Indian fighter. And at the same time, he found that his troops were not as efficient as they could have been. There was a lot of drinking. There was very poor training. They almost never got live ammunition for marksmanship, so that their marksmanship was really poor. They had no tactical training, and so he had to embark on a campaign against the Indians, but he had to shape up the soldiers that he was with. And over the next several years, he was very successful at doing that.
That really mattered considering the types of campaigns that he waged. And in reading your book and reading about the campaigns he waged, first against the Paiutes and associated tribes, and then against the Apache, and then, of course, finally against the Sioux, he has a approach that really would, I guess you could summarize as attritional warfare. And I could see why it was successful, but you also highlight the demand that it placed upon both the men and the animals that they had with them, the mules that they needed for transport, the horses that the cavalry rode. And you frequently describe through the book how over the course of these campaigns that they would be. The soldiers would become gaunt, and they would, scurvy was a problem, which is not something we oftentimes think about with land forces. We associate more with sailing ships in the 18th and 19th centuries, and it really conveys the demands that were put upon these men. And yet you also highlight that George Crook was a man who commanded from the front, and he assumed a lot of these burdens himself.
Well, that's true. I think the main problem in campaigning in the West, particularly in the Great Basin, was lack of water and forage. And the lack of forage in particular meant that they could only go on, short distances. And one of Crook's many innovations as a soldier in the West was the innovation of the pack train. He was very high on mules, and in fact he rode one himself, a mule named Apache, and because he found them to be more hardy and more susceptible to the visages of the of campaigning, and he virtually wrote the book on campaigning with mules, and he used them both as pack animals and as his personal mount. The conditions under which these people operated, the soldiers operated, was extremely rough. I think what you were referencing with the scurvy was the hunger march during the Sioux War, where he was on the trail for about 3 months, and they ran out of food to the extent that they were killing their own horses and eating them, which to a cavalryman was just almost akin to being a cannibal. And so that particular march went down in history as one of the really terrible events of the Indian Wars. But, they had these experiences as well with the weather. He introduced the whole concept of winter campaigning, which up to that time had been, almost considered an impossibility, particularly in the Mountain West, where temperatures reached 40 degrees below zero and there were huge snowstorms. And the Indians at that point would go into camp for the winter in sheltered areas, and they would not go out again until the spring, when they could fatten their ponies on the forage that was available. So they were kind of vulnerable at that point, because they were not mobile, and if you could find their camps, you could actually engage them. Which in the summertime and springtime, when they could move about the prairies was virtually impossible. So he would go out on these winter campaigns with his troops, and they would be bundled up in these buffalo robes and stuff just to survive the sub-zero temperatures, and try to imagine trying to fight in a situation where you're completely bundled up in a buffalo robe. So they would actually go into battle in their shirt sleeves, which was, in 40 degree below zero weather is, almost lethal. And yet they actually, accomplished quite a great deal. And winter campaigning and his aggressiveness in keeping after the Indians and not allowing them these winter refuges was a very effective tactic, as you pointed out.
You describe as well how in the Great Basin he was facing a lot of political pressure to exterminate the Paiute. You mentioned the territorial governor was calling for it. There were local newspaper editors that the settlers were, that's what they wanted. What were George Crook's own views about Native Americans, and what was his ultimate intention when it came to winning these wars? Like, what was his goal in terms of the peace that he was seeking to pursue with the tribes he was fighting?
Well, that's one of the things that attracted me to George Crook as an individual. His primary concern was to make peace with the Indians, not to exterminate them. He was not a person who believed in extermination. He saw the Indians. He himself was an outdoors person. He loved hunting. He loved fishing. He loved nature. And he saw in the Indians a reflection in part of himself. And, he saw in their lifestyle a worthwhile pursuit. And what he tried to do was to find a solution that would allow him to subdue the Indians without, too great a hardship on them, and get them onto reservations that were really on their own traditional lands, so they could subsist the way they had always subsisted, yet not get into conflict with the settlers and the miners. So his aim was always to wage ferocious war in order to have a short war, and his objective was to bring the Indians to the peace table. He recognized that as a warrior culture, I don't know if he recognized, but this was his thinking, that the Indian was a warrior culture. The Indian culture was a warrior culture, and that if we expected them to make peace with us, they would have to be taught that there was no percentage in making war, that, that they had met a foe that was stronger than them. And so that was his objective, was to impress the Indians with his ability and strength and the futility of fighting, the onslaught of white immigration that was filling up the West, that it was inevitable, and that they had to make terms with it, and they better do it quickly, or they were going to have a bad time of it. And so that was basically his objective.
How successful was he in achieving that objective with the Paiute?
He was very successful, and it made his reputation. He through the use of the use of mule trains and the use of Indian scouts, which I could probably get into a little bit more, was able to convince them that their resistance was futile. And he also, at the same time, was able to secure for them, at least in the short term, reservations that were in accordance with their own traditional territories, so that they were not placed in places where they would starve to death, which was a later eventuality in our policies with the Indians. But unfortunately, you know, the Interior Department, which took charge of the of Indians once they were on the reservation, had a policy of what they called removal and consolidation, so that eventually the Indians were taken from the kind of reservations that, that Crook had hoped to secure for them on a permanent basis and placed in much less salubrious environments where, in fact, they suffered greatly. And, his success was short-lived in terms of securing for the Indians a permanent lifestyle within, you know, within the white civilization. That was not to occur. And, you know, even today, it's, you know, it hasn't occurred.
You mentioned how the campaign helped to make his reputation as a successful Indian fighter. Was that why he was then dispatched to the Arizona Territory?
Exactly. There was a lot of pressure for him to go to Arizona because the situation in Arizona had following the Civil War, had become really very, very precarious for the whites. The Apaches had been fighting intruders into their territory for 200 or 300 years, and were very successful. They had kept the Spanish bottled up in small forts and had resisted, you know, the Mexicans as well. And now they were fighting with the white settlers that came pouring into Arizona during and after the Civil War. Again, because one, it was a good place for ranching, and two, because it was mineral rich territory. So the governor Safford of Arizona was, you know, had heard about Crook's success up in the, you know, in the Paiute country, and asked that he be assigned to Arizona. And Crook at first was extremely reluctant. He knew something of the conditions in Arizona, having traveled through it during his early days in California. And, you know, it was very extremely hot in the summer, and it was full of cactuses and poisonous snakes and so on and so forth. The way that 19th century American travelers described Arizona, it sounded like hell on earth. And basically, General Sherman said, we fought one war with Mexico to acquire Arizona, and we should fight another to get rid of it.
The situation in Arizona was nicely illustrated in another respect, which was that Crook's predecessor, Colonel Stoneman, was preferring to command the troops in Arizona Territory from an office in San Diego.
Right. That didn't go over very big in Arizona. So eventually the army wore Crook down and sent him to Arizona, and he was to be the head of a department, and his rank was too low to, he was a lieutenant colonel, to command a department. So they jumped him over 9 colonels of the line who had seniority over him to make him a brigadier general and to give him that position. And it incurred the enmity of you know, many officers of the line at that time, because they didn't like there was intense competition for promotion, because the slots at the top of the scale were very limited and could only be filled after an occupant either died or retired. And since there was no retirement plan in the army, most officers didn't retire, so it was very hard to, you know, to get an opening for promotion to general. And I think that was probably one of the big, you know, influential factors in Crook's deciding to accept that position. It was almost too much to turn down.
That actually gets to another interesting aspect of Crook's life that you talk about. You describe him as something of a retiring personality. He was not the flamboyant figure that, say, George Custer was. But you also mentioned that he did have a good sense of the importance of public relations in terms of advancing his career. And I was wondering if you could explain that aspect of Crook, both his personality and also how he is involved with, in a sense, promoting his career through by bringing in these reporters who provided chronicles of his campaigns.
Well, there's been a lot made of his use of newspaper reporters. To my mind, too much has been made of it. I believe that, in fact, you know, he did use reporters to a certain extent, but no more than any other officer, either today or in those days. You know, I think for career Army officers, advancement is critical, and I think after a while they become very savvy as to how that is done. But several historians have alleged that Crook took reporters with him everywhere on campaign with the specific idea that they would, you know, talk him up and give him favorable publicity so that he could go ahead and get advancement. I think that's been greatly exaggerated. I went into some detail, for example, about the reporters who covered him during the Sioux War and indicated that all of them came there because they were assigned to the job, not because he finagled their presence on the campaign. And that's true of his campaigns in Idaho and again in Arizona. I think newspapermen were attracted to him because he was an interesting, eccentric, enigmatic figure, and he was successful. And when he was around, there was action, and they wanted to cover action for their newspapers. The newspapers at the time were highly competitive, and Indian stories were good press, good copy. So while he was, he was a man who did not like pomp and did not wear the uniform whenever on most occasions. He often wore canvas clothing, which was more resistant to the rough and ready conditions on the trail. He rode a mule, as I mentioned before. Instead of wearing military clothing, he wore a Japanese-style pith helmet. He was very very reticent and as far as sharing his ideas with his fellow officers or anyone else, and they often were frustrated by that. His aide, John Burke, who served as his mouthpiece with the press, I think, to a certain extent, described his staff meeting as he goes off by himself, sits on a rock, whittles on a stick for a while, and then comes back and tells the rest of his staff what they're going to be doing. I think that's pretty accurate. He did play things very close to his chest, and it did frustrate a number of his subordinates.
And again, though, he goes in Arizona, he wages these campaigns, and again, he does seem to have considerable success in establishing a degree of stability in the region. And I was wondering if you could explain, though, why it is that his campaigns in Arizona were not quite as successful, though, as the ones in the Great Basin.
Well, in fact, they were. His campaigns in Arizona in the 1870s were what actually made him famous as an Indian fighter. Very few people had heard about the Great Basin outside of the military. Were aware of his achievements there, and that was the basis that they sent him to Arizona. But Arizona really put him on the map nationally as an Indian fighter. He organized a campaign against the Western Apaches, who were one of the most significant groups of Apaches that were creating problems in Arizona. That really brought them to their knees within a year and a half, and it was that combination of aggressive campaigning with the very important use of Apache scouts to hunt their own people. He was able, because of his knowledge of the Indians and his ability to deal with them, to convince a number of Apaches to act as his scouts, and they became more than just simply trackers. They became fighters as well, and their presence was absolutely critical to his victories in Arizona, and that and his ability to negotiate with them once the tribes had been taught the lesson of just how tough he could be, he could bring them to the table and negotiate with them and try to get them reservations again that were places where they could actually survive. And again, he was thwarted in that direction because his efforts to give them decent lands was subverted by the Interior Department and their removal policy, where they concentrated all of the tribes at San Carlos Reservation, which is probably one of the greatest hell holes in Arizona.
So. You also described, though, there's an additional dynamic that he did not face when dealing with the Paiute, which was the international dimension. Arizona being on the border with Mexico, you had and how the reservations oftentimes being placed against the border meant that in some ways the problem was simply being shifted for a period of time to Mexico, and how that was going to be a problem to which he would eventually have to return to address down the road.
Yeah, well, the Mexican issue was not as prominent in the 1870s as it would later become during the Geronimo campaigns of the 1880s, which is this dealt with in my third book. But one of the bands of the of Apaches that was the most ferocious, who were the most ferocious warriors, were the Chiricahuas. And Crook did not have access to the Chiricahuas because they came under the protection of General Howard, who negotiated a separate peace with them. And their home country was the Dragoon Mountains, which is on the border with Mexico. And they were the ones who would slip across the border and commit depredations in Mexico, and at the same time turn around and smile at everybody in Arizona and say, well, see, we're not bothering you. And so that was an issue that Crook could not deal with because, as I said, it was that was General Howard's purview. And General Howard had made a separate peace with Cochise, who was the chief of the Chiricahua, and that had taken the whole matter out from under Crook's control, and that gave Crook a lot of heartburn.
As you mentioned, though, he was successful enough to where now he has such stature that he's appointed the head of the Department of the Platte. And I was wondering if you could explain a bit what responsibilities came with that position and what were some of the issues he was dealing with in that part of the country.
Well, yeah. it gets very complicated, but in the Platte, you had the Black Hills, and gold was discovered in the Black Hills. The Black Hills had been promised to the Sioux as part of the Great Sioux Reservation in a treaty that was entered into with them in 1868. And the army was tasked with keeping miners out of the Black Hills in conformity with the treaty, but it was a nearly impossible task and one that they did not embrace wholeheartedly anyway, because the country was going through a depression, and you know the gold that would come out of the Black Hills would help the economy, and the whole idea of having miners go into the area was one that was favored by the government. And eventually, Grant decided that, you know, who was president at the time, Grant decided that, the national interest was really in taking the Black Hills away from the Sioux, and they needed a casus belli. And so they sort of invented a situation where they could provoke the Sioux. They gave the Sioux an ultimatum, and that they had to come in and surrender and go onto the reservation by a certain date. And it was in January when the snow was very deep on the ground. It was virtually impossible for them to comply. And several weeks after they gave the ultimatum date, after the ultimatum date had expired, basically the government declared war on the Sioux. And Crook had been transferred there in anticipation of this situation a year earlier. And so it was his job really to begin to prosecute this war while the government organized its reinforcements in the form of an army to go after the Sioux. And so he engaged in what was known as the Powder River Campaign as one of the earliest campaigns in the Sioux War, and struck a village which he thought was going to be the village of the Sioux, who were the primary enemy, but turned out to be a Cheyenne village. And it was an interesting campaign that's described in the book in detail, but it was basically it was unsuccessful because the Cheyenne just moved out into the mountains and escaped the soldiers, and they were so disaffected that they joined the Sioux and reinforced the Sioux and were present at the Little Bighorn later on when Custer met them.
It was a really interesting section of the book in that you intertwine both Crook's campaigns against the Sioux and other tribes, but you also get into some of the relationships that Crook had with the other officers in his command, and how a lot of those relationships were defined by the degree to which they would criticize or blame each other for the failure to achieve certain goals. I was thinking particularly about the Battle of the Rosebud, where you describe how years afterward they're still arguing with each other over what they that they weren't at a certain place at a certain time, and that's why the battle turned out the way that it did.
Yeah, I the friction really started at the Powder River, where Crook had a general, a colonel working for him, as a subordinate, Colonel Reynolds, who was, I think, over the hill, and he'd never been a great general, but at the time of Powder River, he was aging, and so Crook assigned him to attack this Cheyenne village. And he dropped the ball, and Crook later court-martialed him. And some of Reynolds' officers were alienated by that whole that whole situation. And, you know, it caused a split within Crook's force that was exacerbated at the Rosebud and continued, you know, for several years thereafter. And you know, there was a lot of partisanship in the army in those days, and he was caught up in the middle of it.
And yet, in spite of the personality conflicts, and in spite of the arduousness of things like the Horse Meat March, and in spite of the setbacks like Little Bighorn, Crook ultimately succeeds in his goal, doesn't he?
Well, yeah. it was kind of convoluted, but eventually he, again, because of his knowledge of the psychology of the Indians and because of his reputation as being a truth talker, somebody that the Indians could trust, he was able to negotiate peace with the various bands of the Sioux, and in that way brought an end to the Sioux War, despite the fact that the Sioux had, you know, had won the major, I'd say both major engagements of that, you know, of the war, the Custer Battle and the Battle of the Rosebud. Yet they, you know, they had been devastated by the, you know, by the war because of the attacks on their villages and so on. And I hadn't mentioned it before, but one of the army's techniques during this time was really the introduction of the concept of total war, which Sherman had used in the South during the Civil War, where, you know, civilians and villages and towns were fair game in warfare. Up until that time, that had not been the case. And this concept was used during the Indian Wars, particularly during the Sioux War. And when the army would attack a village, they would kill women and children and old men and you know, non-combatants, and then burn everything. And the Cheyenne in particular were devastated by this, because for some reason most of the attacks that the army was, you know, prosecuted against the enemy during that time were against the Cheyenne villages rather than the Sioux villages, perhaps because the Sioux villages were, you know, more harder to find. I'm not sure exactly why that was, but when they attacked the Cheyenne villages, they virtually destroyed the entire Cheyenne culture, civilization. They burned all of their weapons, all of their tools, all of their food, all of their buffalo robes, all of their teepees, and the Cheyenne were virtually destitute at the end of this time. And in Indian culture, they were, you know, they looked to the Sioux for hospitality and succor during this period. And, you know, so the Sioux not only had to provide for them, for themselves in a time of war, but they had to provide for their Cheyenne allies as well. So the Sioux were also devastated by this and impoverished by this. And so when the time came for Crook to negotiate a peace, he was dealing with an enemy that was, you know, almost on its knees at that point.
You mentioned that you're addressing Geronimo in the third volume. How's the third volume coming along?
Well, I've completed the original draft of it, and I'm looking to I'm going to edit it and get the photographs and the maps and so on together. And that process probably will take another 6 months or so. And, you know, by that time, I should be able to, you know, hopefully convince the Oklahoma Press to accept the book and publish it. It's going to cover the Geronimo campaign in over half the book is going to be devoted to his return to Arizona, because that was the most interesting and controversial part of his career. And it really goes into the book really goes into his the humanitarian phase of his life, when all of those humanitarian instincts that had motivated him during his early years really came to the fore, because at this point the Indians had been were no longer the free living free roaming Indians that they had been in his early career, but they were confined to reservations, and as I've said before, most of these reservations were in impoverished areas where they couldn't support themselves. The government was very stingy on its rationing, and in some cases there was widespread starvation. And Crook could see all this, and he could see that, you know, all it did was breed more conflict, because the Indians would break out in desperation and try to get themselves food, and it was a situation where he finally recognized that he needed to engage the government in an open policy debate about the treatment of the Native Americans. And so a lot of the book is devoted to his struggles with this issue. And I must say that ultimately he was not successful. If you look around you today, you can see that.
Well, I do look forward to reading it when it comes out. Paul, thank you very much for taking some time out of your preparations of the next volume to speak with us about Volume 2. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.